Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Richie Hardcore is a retired Thai boxing champion who, even to his own surprise, has become a respected anti-violence campaigner in Aotearoa. Richie is a sought-after public speaker who talks at schools and universities and details his own childhood trauma and encourages our young men to be vulnerable about their feelings. In this episode of Take It From Us, we speak about Richie's evidence-based approach to violence prevention, living in a society that has normalised unhealthy behaviours, the benefits he still gets from talk therapy, and his unwavering passion for social change. The name Richie Hardcore, should we start there? I'm guessing that's not your birth name, would I be right?
Yeah, you're 100% correct, Kent. Yeah, most people start there. I grew up in a musical subculture called the hardcore scene. And so hardcore came out of the American punk scene, and it was kind of like a stripped back sound, and then a whole sort of like ethos and political ideology and stuff, and style and fashion and musical sound kind of evolved out of that, right? And so as a kid, I listened to like hip-hop music and metal, like Metallica and Guns N' Roses and stuff, and then, you know, like gangster rap. And then as I got older and got introduced into hardcore and towards the end of my high school years, I really fell in love with it. And then we would form our own bands and make like fanzines, and I inherited a radio show at Auckland's 95 BFM. It was called Viva La Hardcore. It was like my first public platform when I was maybe 19 or 20. And yeah, it just kind of evolved from there. And then at the same time, I was building myself as a Thai boxer, and hardcore became my ring name when I was fighting. Cause I used to like play hardcore music in the gym, and I also used to have a very aggressive fighting style, and just predicated on fitness and aggression. And so people call me like, yo, what's up, hardcore? Like kickboxers, we're all pretty corny, and we call each other psycho and hitman and hardcore and stuff like that. And, you know, sort of there was this coalescence with the music thing. And just when I was 27, I thought it'd be funny to change my name to Richie Hardcore. I'm like my depot. Yeah, and now I'm 44 and I talk about pornography in schools. I have to explain that situation. Sure. But yeah, that's where it came from.
Appreciate you explaining that. And you've become a public speaker educator. You do have a profile. A lot of people in New Zealand would be familiar with a lot of your work and what you do. Would it be fair to say that role has grown organically rather than going through a clinical sense of becoming qualified and doing all of these years of work to get to where you are? It's an organic role?
Yeah, Kent, totally, bro. Like my professional work has really just been me following what felt right at the time. It's been as I've personally grown and personally wanted to explore things, it's led to professional opportunities. Often I just have said yes to stuff and not even known if I'd be any good at it. And I've just learned from a process of trial and error. And when I've been really passionate about something, I'm like, okay, cool, how do I get more academic understandings of that? And I've gone off to study for a few years here and there, you know. But yeah, a lot of my professional work's predicated on my personal life and my personal experiences. And I've overlapped, yeah, professional understandings and best practice and academic understandings over that. So it's not just my story. Say if I'm doing a public speaking event, I can point to the research and the reference, qualitative and quantitative data. For some people, that's important, and for me, it's important. Obviously, right? Like, I spent years in university to come to those understandings, but that's not what shifts people's views and ideas and values or makes them reflect. Right? They need to have an emotive response to something to help them reflect on their values or why they think the way they think or do the things that they do that might be dangerous or violent or unhelpful for them or the people around them, man. So, yeah, to your question, it is just I never set out to be a public speaker. I never set out to be an advocate around family violence or porn or any of these things. Just opportunities have emerged, and I've said yes to them, and I've just kind of followed my nose.
Yeah, and what is your approach as a public speaker different than it would have been a few years ago?
Oh, yeah, entirely, man. Like, I was talking about this, actually. I was giving a seminar to an audience of men who are emerging change makers around masculinity. And when I first started talking about domestic violence and gender equality, maybe 20 years ago, just on message boards and chat groups, and then that evolved into social media and mainstream media, I had this very jargon-heavy feminist rhetoric that was popular with activists and online feminists, but not popular with boys and men. And actually, that's who I need to be talking with, right? Like, we do have the worst rate of domestic violence in the OECD in our country. We have really high rates of suicide, substance abuse, mental illness, for boys and men. And if you don't bring them into the conversation, that's never going to change. Like, so as I've evolved from just talking about my emerging understandings to being in the professional space and then going on to work with, you know, every week I have my own charitable trust now, and I work with men and women and young people who are in the justice system. So they're either transitioning from prison or potentially going to prison. Many who have perpetrated really serious violence. You actually have to, like, meet people where they are, man, and have some sort of grace for their lived experience. And judgment and shame, I've learned, aren't, like, effective change-making strategies. You actually have to talk with people and be patient and explore their value system in a way that resonates with them if you have any hope of wanting people to self-reflect and grow, right? And alongside that professional evolution, as I've observed, like, the culture war take hold in the West from, like, 2014, 15 onwards, I've become super disillusioned with the way that progressive forces talk to others and about others in a way that's really haughty, and there's a lot of, like, cancel culture and othering, and there's a real hierarchy of who's got the right ideas and who's got the wrong ideas. And this political polarization and social polarization, I think, is really socially destabilizing and does nothing to make the world better. So I've, you know, I think in my early years, I was part of that. And as I've actually been, you know, fallen foul of that and come to reflect on that whole aspect of social activism, I've disavowed it and looked to, I guess, like, have grace at the forefront of my change making rather than judgment and shame and anger, you know?
So maybe once upon a time you would have taken a hardcore approach to almost a militant style of activism, and yeah, now you've really refined it and are perhaps more empathetic and open to other people's experience to help see your lens of how you see the world.
Entirely. And it's not even my lens, right? Like, it's, I mean, like I said, like, a lot of stuff I talk about is based in a fair amount of evidence and research. But I remember when a famous sports person was charged with raping someone. And he's before the courts. And this is going back years, right? So, if you, dear listener, know that I think this is stupid now. And I put some rant on Facebook, and I'm like, if you see this person, punch him in the face for me. Like, it was just a mode of response that was stupid. And also, like, I don't believe that punching people in the face is a good way to solve our endemic social problems. It was from a place of my own hurt and a place of my own emotional reactions to something that I think is despicable. And it went really viral, like, the algorithm's always changing, right? But when you put something, like, insane out there like that, heaps of people see it. So, like, literally, the metrics are, like, over a million people had seen this post, including, like, friends of the alleged perpetrator and yada, yada, yada. But that's a stupid thing. That's not productive. That's not a productive way to stop sexual violence, right? Like, and it was before the courts. Like, I believe in due process. Like, while our criminal justice system is imperfect, particularly when it comes to sexual violence and family violence and these sorts of things, it's still the best we've got, right? I don't believe that you can just accuse someone and then done. Like, let's execute them to the gallows. Like, we have a legal system that is important, and sort of big pronouncements like I used to make actually disrespect that legal system, right? So, yeah, it's an imperfect system, but unless you think that random people on social media are the judge, jury, and executioner of someone's life, then you need to step back and temper your emotional responses to alleged crimes and work with, okay, what are the cultural drivers and social drivers that lead a young man to perpetrate actions like that? How do we ensure that everyone has a robust understanding of what enthusiastic consent looks like? How do we ensure that people know that the narratives that they're consuming on the regular from pornography and mainstream culture are really unhealthy, damaging narratives? If you want to stop sexual violence like I do, and I imagine you do, and most of your listeners do, in fact, hopefully all, right? Just going around saying punch people in the face isn't a helpful way to do it. Like, you actually need to sit down and talk with people.
Did that need to be pointed out to you? Did you figure it out for yourself?
No, one of the bros that I really look up to, he's like a real big brother, Tuakana, Phil Paikia, who was one of the original It's Not Okay campaign champions. He was a man who was this is all public record. He was in the Black Power. He used to be domestically violent, like quite severely. You know, he was on the wrong side of the tracks, but he changed his ways and became one of our leading anti-violence advocates alongside a wonderful man named Vic Tamati. And yeah, Uncle Phil just jumped on and was like, bro, you know, like, this isn't the way to talk about these things. And they ended up typing up some like apology, which I genuinely meant, right? And that was years ago, probably about 10 years ago. And it's all shifted now in that the way I spoke then has actually become cool for a lot of young activists. Like, actually, the more outrageous and cancel-y that you are, the more of a personal brand that you can develop, the more clout that you get, the more popular you get, right? Like, there are whole social media accounts predicated on their notion of social justice that I really resonate with the desired outcomes, but I disagree with the approach, because working on the ground with violent offenders, men and women, I just know that it doesn't work in real life. Like, it really doesn't. You can't use haughty academic jargon and approaches and have like these really black and white binary presumptions of life and expect that to work in the grimy gray of reality.
Right? You mentioned judgment a little bit earlier, and you related that to shame. And we are very, very good at judging as human beings. We all do it. We judge ourselves. We judge each other. We judge circumstance. Most of the time, it's not particularly productive. It's not particularly helpful. So have you seen that when people feel that judgment, there's not likely to become that change that you are hoping to see, or that they are maybe hoping for themselves?
What I've come to observe and come to learn is that when you are ashamed of your own behavior based on an implicit understanding of something, that is a driver of change. If you're like, I've let my family down, I've let myself down, I'm so ashamed of the people I've hurt, How do I change? Like, how do I do the work? That leads to lasting change, whether that's around substance abuse and addiction or mental health issues or domestic violence or taking accountability of other forms of harm, right? When judgment is externally imposed by means of social exclusion or ridicule or putting people in the stocks of social media these days, that often leads to people doubling down on their beliefs, values, and behaviors. It makes them defensive rather than open to conversation. It makes them actually leave the spaces that could lead to change and find themselves in an environment that actually normalizes antisocial, unhealthy belief systems and values, right? Like if you talk to many people who are in gang environments, for example, those are some of our most socially excluded people who actually have built organically a support network around them of people who make themselves feel normal, if you put it very simply, right? Like Middle New Zealand, I think, understandably, does want to address the gang issue because gangs do cause harm. Gangs do sell drugs. Gangs do use violence. Gangs do have a whole range of anti-social actions that fall out of them. But at the same time, judgment and shame and it making like owning a gang patch an offense that can lead to incarceration isn't going to fix it, right? Like, how do you help people do the long work of healing? How do you provide support services? You know, some people will be like, oh, this is just some mamby-pamby stuff, but it's actually you can do two things at the same time and we don't seem to be able to have that conversation anymore. It's like, yeah, if someone is selling methamphetamine en masse, if someone is perpetrating violence, carrying guns, using domestic violence, they need to, for a period, lose their rights, right? They need to be incarcerated. But if you want to stop them doing that again and again and again, as many do, incarceration by itself doesn't work. You actually need to walk alongside them and teach them skills that they've never had. Like, I literally meet people who've been smoking methamphetamine since before they're 13, or they've been, like, the rate of childhood sexual abuse in our gangs, insane, dude. Like, all being victims of parental violence or witness to it, and just recreating what's familiar to them again and again and again, right? And we need to carry grace for that. And if we really want to be more than just political sound bites, be in it for the long haul. And I think a lot of like social justice people on the left can hold that grace for certain demographics of society, but don't carry the same grace for others. It's like, all right, cool. Well, here's your middle-aged straight white guy who's got some racist and sexist beliefs. Well, where do those beliefs come from? What culture was he brought up in? What environment shaped his way of thinking? And how do you walk alongside him for the long haul and help him change so that he doesn't pass those values on to his children? Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. We need to apply the same patience and grace for everyone. And often we're quite selective in how we do that, depending on our positionality, right? So how do we actually carry grace for everyone to build a more equitable society?
When you go and speak to universities and schools, is there a key message that you have?
It depends on what I'm invited to talk about. A lot of my work is in masculinities these days. Like, it used to be domestic violence and sexual violence and quite nuts and bolts. Like, this is what power and control is, and this is what a healthy and unhealthy, and this is coercive control. But I've been on this journey to try and figure out, like, why so many men so violent to so many women? And then as my work's expanded to each other, right? Like, I don't know about you, but I've never been beaten up by a girl. I've only ever gotten fistfights with men. I've never been stepped out or robbed by a woman. It's only ever been men. I've never had a woman tell me, like, what are you looking at? I'm going to smash you over. You know, like, never been robbed by a woman. You know what I mean? It's always men. So why is that? Why are my male friends exponentially more likely to kill themselves or have a drug problem? You know, why are so many men lonely and stressed and, you know, burnt out? And as I've done the work, if you look at a lot of our dominant ideas about what we think it means to be a man, like how to perform our masculinity, it leads to a lot of these negative outcomes, right? So that's what I tend to talk about a lot more now. Like I wrote a master's degree looking at those cultural ideas around masculinity. And yeah, really, I'm just trying to talk through a lot of the, I guess the cultural side that leads us to think being a man is being tough, being homophobic, making sex jokes, sleeping around, being infatigable. Like, yeah, man, like a man never rests. Like, like using violence as a problem-solving tool. You know, pursuit of status. I've got to have a certain sort of car. I've got to have a certain sort of income. I've got to look a certain way. Like, all these things are quite transferable, whether you are working 100-hour weeks with Versace suits on and doing cocaine in the weekends because you're so overwhelmed, or you are, you know, and you're driving a Porsche, or you're driving a souped-up Holden and you've got a gang patch, you're still putting a mask on to some degree, right? You're still not letting yourself be soft and gentle, and it burns us out, and it leads to some sort of, like, damage in yourself and the people around you, man. So, yeah, I talk through that a lot. You know, I think there are a lot of intersections that lead to poor mental health, that lead to poor that lead to family violence, that lead to, you know, any number of harms. And it's not solely our cultural ideas around masculinity. There are all these different intersections, but that's one part of the puzzle that I think we do a poor job of discussing. So that's where a lot of my work lies.
Do you think young men are open to being more vulnerable now than they would have been in our day, for want of a better phrase?
No, it's definitely our day. We could admit that we're middle aged, bro. It's all good.
I know that's. I like to tell myself I'm still a young man, but I know I'm actually not.
Well, me too, bro. I'm literally like doing kickboxing and Muay Thai and punching face with like 18-year-olds every day. And it's Peter Pan syndrome in my mind. But
hey, it helps keep. It's a good way to help keep you young anyway. Young
spirit. It keeps you young spirit, and it also, given my broader kaupapa, keeps me like on the ground with young people. Like, there's no point in me going into school and trying to pretend I know what they're dealing with if I don't. But I'm working with young people every day in all manner of all spheres of life. To your question, yeah, I think there is a greater willingness for people to discuss emotions and not be think it's like unmanly or like that's what girls do, quote unquote. And that's really cool. Like, I think we should acknowledge that we've come a long way, but we've still got a lot further to go, right? Like, if we never account for positive social changes, there's no hope in that. And actually, in many ways, for all the work that myself and those that I'm colleagues with and people in this change-making space do, a lot of good has happened, right? Like, actually, there is a lot, you know, if you look at a graph over time, like, in many ways, we're living at the best time in history, right? So we shouldn't discount that.
You've talked before about your own past and a trauma-informed approach that you take, and you value talk therapy. You still talk to counsellors to help with things in your own life?
Oh, yeah, dude, entirely. Yeah, so I've been seeing the same psychologist for a long time now, and I see her actually less and less, but I still check in, you know, like my own life has issues, you know, like I have stress and people tell me terrible things all the time, and, you know, like it's you know, like I have two kids and I'm married and like life is tricky sometimes and you need an external perspective on it. So, yeah, I see a psychologist sometimes. I see a couple of different ones. Sometimes I want different perspectives. I have a good circle of colleagues in the domestic violence and sexual violence prevention space and masculinity space that I can have informal chats to, right? Like, life is an inherently painful, difficult thing to have. How do you best deal with it? Well, you need support. Like, no one of us is an island, right? Like, humans are deeply social creatures, and I think we're amiss to think otherwise, right? Like, the weight of the world will crush you no matter how tough you think you are. So a psychologist, friends, support networks, like, informal therapeutic communities. Like, Muay Thai is therapeutic for me. Like, talking with my friends stretching after we've been training is therapeutic. Talking on a run is therapeutic. it's therapeutic, but it's not therapy, I think. That's where people get messed up, right?
Yes.
Like, oh, you know, like...
Yes. And there's still a bit of a stigma there to going to see a psychologist or to go and see a counsellor because, oh, there must be something wrong with you. Are you okay? What's wrong with you? I'm like you. I go and see a counsellor every so often and I've got friends who are psychologists and other coaches and sometimes we meet for a coffee and it feels so bloody good just to talk and just to get stuff out there. There's nothing wrong. I'm not broken. I don't need fixing, but I might have a whole lot of stuff wrapped around in my head that I need to tell someone. And how great is it to know that we've got people that we can talk to about these things?
Dude, entirely. I think if we could continue that work, it will lead long term to all sorts of positive outcomes, right? And I'm happy that I see young people speaking more. I worry that. And this is perhaps a tangent, I do worry that we have almost romanticized illness for certain cohorts. Like if you go on social media, mental health, mental illness, all these sorts of things are like huge hashtags and we've almost overshot and pathologized normal human behavior or normal human experiences. And I think that's something we need to be mindful of when we're talking about mental illness is that it really sucks to be depressed. Like feeling like killing yourself is horrible. Feeling defeated and having insomnia and not being present in your relationships because you're mentally unwell. They're all terrible things. And we need to help people understand that it's actually really cool to be just like boring and stable. Because a lot of our, well, at least a lot of the music, a lot of the videos, a lot of the movies that I watch and have always watched kind of like make that a little bit cool and trendy, right? And on social media, that's become a whole thing. Like people are self-diagnosing with all manner of ailments. So we need to help people be a bit more discerning too, particularly our younger people, like Gen Z people.
Yeah. And having a bad day doesn't necessarily mean that you're mentally unwell.
Dude, like... breaking up with your girlfriend is emotionally distressing. It doesn't, you know, like breaking up with your boyfriend is emotionally distressing. People dying, your pet dying, a stressful day at work, like not doing well on an exam. All these things are part of life, right? But it doesn't mean that you're depressed, right? Those are different things, right? So if you're in that space for a long, long period of time and your habits are shifting, you're not sleeping, you're not eating and you're thinking dark thoughts repetitively, if you're stuck in rumination, then maybe you are depressed. Having a low mood doesn't necessarily equate to depression, though. So how do we continue to have that broader conversation, that sort of media literacy around that?
I think talking about living a healthy life goes a long way to addressing some of that stuff. But the power of food, the power of diet, the power of sleep, exercise, moving... I've talked about this before, Richie, as a coach. I think these basic, simple things are grossly underestimated as being the powerful things that they have always been for humans, but modernity has taken us further and further away to a heavily medicated society where these things are just not valued as much. Would you agree?
I entirely agree with that. So I do. So I got into talking about mental health maybe in 2013. Mike King, who's one of like the forerunners of opening up the discussion around mental health in our country, he invited me to be a guest on his radio show that he founded, the Nutters Club, which was a mental health focused talkback show. And then after he invited me to be a guest, since I had a history in radio, he was like, bro, do you want to fill in for me when I'm not here? So I would do sort of mainstream talkback, albeit late night, with a psychologist in the studio all the time or a psychiatrist. And that began sort of like my mental health advocacy work. And then businesses got in touch and like, hey, do you do keynote speaking about mental wellness and blah, blah, blah? And I was like, I'll figure it out. So my academic training is political science and sociology. So I'm quick to say I'm not a psychiatrist. I have a lived experience of poor mental health, but I can give you a sociological overview of what leads to good mental health. And it's exactly the stuff that you're talking about, Kent. Like modernity has made us unwell. Like there is so much data now that tells us If you look at the work of like Jonathan Haidt and Gene Twenge and Greg Lukianoff, that social media is so bad for our young people when it comes to mental wellness, so bad that we have more loneliness, we have less sexual connection, we have like more porn consumption, but people aren't dating and hooking up. Like, we don't eat natural food anymore. People don't move enough. We've got like epidemic rates of obesity, which is linked to depression and poor mental well-being. Like, if you look at our food, I was thinking about this. So I'm privileged enough to have recently taken a holiday in Thailand with my family. And I don't know if you've been to Thailand, but I've been here, a dozen times. I used to fight Muay Thai. And, like, you can buy, like, fruit and natural foods on the side of the road for a relatively cheap price. You can just snack on fruit all the time. Or, like, I'm a vegetarian, but, you know, buy my kids, like, a chicken skewer or whatever it is.
Real food.
Real food, bro. And you want to buy a snack here? It's like 50,000 chemicals and ingredients. You go to this, dear listener, go to the gas station, go to the gas station and look at the ingredients. Like, how many things are in the quote unquote food? We don't eat food anymore. We eat food like substances. And I can fall into that because I'm busy and I'm trying to, like, you know, be useful and healthy, but we don't eat food anymore, man. And then we wonder why we're so, like, unwell mentally and spiritually. We're so disconnected from this system that's meant to sustain us. It's really sad. And even our commercial food systems are so detrimental to the environment that I worry that, are we going to even have natural food anymore? It's mad. Like, we're destroying our seas and pillaging them and... I don't know. It's very troubling if you zoom out. So as much as I was saying, like, things are better in some ways, they're worse than others. And our food system is terrible. Like, whole food. Are you familiar with the idea of a food desert?
Yeah.
Like, I forget the film I watched, but it was looking at America, and there are like huge geographic areas that are considered food deserts.
You can't get
natural
decent
food. It's just like 7-Elevens and gas stations and like Walmarts full of like shit. And increasingly New Zealand's becoming like that, and it sucks.
It does. It does suck. And we could talk about that topic for hours and hours and hours, but we need to wrap this up. It's been awesome to have you on. And we've covered off quite a few things that would trouble both of us, and there's some bad, nasty stuff out there, and it's easy to be pessimistic.
It is.
You keep going, right? You're still going hard. Because somewhere in there, there's optimism. Tell me about that.
Well, if I can zoom out, my life is exponentially better than I ever thought it could be as a child because I worked hard to make it that way. Like, I'm not a naturally easygoing person, but I've learned to build a life around things that make me happy. And I've seen myself change, and then I found a profession or a career or a calling or a kaupapa that watches other people change all the time, and I know that change is possible. Like, I've seen people come from, like, the hardest backgrounds you can imagine, whether that's rural poverty in Thailand to being born into cycles of family violence and drug addiction and sexual abuse, and watch people change and heal and grow, right? Like, there's so much possibility out there that I can never lose sight of. You know, I have this tattoo on my arm that says in Spanish, rezo para que otro mundo sea posible. Like, I pray a better world is possible or another world is possible. And I do that, right? And you can't just, like, pray for things. You actually have to take actions to make things happen. And that's what I'm trying to do with people. It's like, yeah, the world can be shitty, but we can change it. Think about anything, you know, like, how did it change? There was a Martin Luther King, or there was a Rosa Parks, or there was a Colin Kaepernick, or there was a Mother Teresa, or, right, like, it just took one person who cared enough to be a little bit different and stand up and speak out and encourage others to do the same. And it's not just talking on the internet and likes and shares. We actually have to, like, get down and get our hands dirty and be patient and have a broad church and agree to disagree and, you know, like, not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, you know, like, Very little is perfect. Nothing's perfect. But how do we still make change and make it possible, you know? And how do we put our difference aside and build bridges? We need to do more of that if we really want to create a better world. And, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like if not you, then who? You know what I mean? Like God has given me an energetic body and mind, and I'm fit and healthy, and I've been fortunate enough to be educated. Why wouldn't I use that to help other people, you know? And it's really rewarding. Like, helping other people is, again, shown to make you happier, right? Like, so from an entirely self-interested point of view, I feel good helping other people. It might not always pay me much or pay me anything, but, like, it's a life worth living. Like, when I die, there will be – I know that I did the most that I could with what I have here. And I guess I'm proud of that, and I'm trying to figure out how to continue to grow that so I can reach more people and build a network of people who can expand what we're doing here, you know?
Really appreciate your time, Richie. Thank you so much.
Yo, peace, man. Thanks a lot for being interested in talking with me. I appreciate the interest, Kent.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy. Our sound engineer is Paul Hannon from Planet FM, and I'm your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story. We'll be right back.